increasingly obsolete. Many physical illnesses have mental components that determine their onset, presentation, and susceptibility to treatment. Terence Dace's symptoms were real. The question under consideration has to do with their origin. That's something I can't help you with.
Understood, I said.
I realized I was fresh out of places to take the conversation, and I was kicking myself for not bringing in a list. What else can I tell you?
I guess that's about it.
I hadn't pressed him on anything, and it was clear I'd never make it as a hard-hitting investigative reporter. We'd covered the subjects superficially, but without anything specific in mind. I was reluctant to take up any more of his time.
Is there anything you want me to tell his daughter?
Convey my condolences. I can understand how devastating this must be. He leaned back in his chair. As long as I have you here, I hope you don't mind if I ask you something.
Sure.
When Terence left the program, he was asked to turn in any medications in his possession.
So I heard, I said.
At that very moment, I had the self-same vial of pills in my bag. My impulse was to avert my eyes, but I held his gaze, filling my head with innocent thoughts instead of the kind that were actually floating around in there. He'd just refilled a prescription. That's one way we ensure conformity, insofar as we can do that with patients who aren't under observation 24 hours a day. According to the clinic pharmacist, he'd just picked up a week's worth, 14 pills. If you have any idea what he might have done with them, we'd love to know. My little lying self kicked in without missing a beat, an impulse predicated on the notion that it's foolish to give up information that might prove useful at a later date.
No clue, I said. Do you know what the medication was?
I made a point of finding out. From a community health perspective, it's dangerous, worse than dangerous. It's potentially fatal to have unidentified chemical compounds circulating among the homeless when so many are drug and alcohol addicted. I said,
I don't know if you're aware of this, but the morning he was found, someone walked off with everything he owned. Some of the items have turned up, but most of his personal belongings are gone. Maybe the pill bottle was in his cart.
I hope somebody had the presence of mind to toss it in the trash, he said. Addicts will knock back just about anything if there's a chance of getting high, and most don't worry about the hazards. If his medication turns up, would you let me know?
Of course, I said.
I glanced down at my shoulder bag and spotted the parking ticket from the lot outside. I pulled it out.
Could I ask you to validate this?
Certainly. Hang on a second. He opened his pencil drawer and rooted around for a moment, finally coming up with a small booklet of stamps about the size of those the post office issues. I passed the ticket across the desk. He checked his watch and then tore out three small stamps that he pasted on the back. These are 15 minutes each, so you should be amply covered.
Thanks.
He handed me the ticket. As I slid it back into my bag, I felt a quick jolt. I'd seen one just like it when I was pulling the crap out of Pete's glove compartment. I looked sharply at Reed, but the phone rang just then. He picked up. This is Dr. Reed. He listened for a moment and looked up at me. Can I call you back on this? I have someone in my office. He listened. 5 minutes, he said. As he hung up, he shot me an apologetic smile, as though embarrassed to have to hurry me out the door. I lifted a finger.
You're the one who called me.
Come again?
June or July. Somebody called me looking for R.T. Dace. I don't know how my number came to light, but I had a brief conversation with a doctor somebody. I didn't catch the name at the time, but I recognized your voice just now."
He shook his head. "Don't think so. Not that I recall. I don't believe we ever had a contact number for him. It might have been someone in the lab."
"Oh, well, maybe so. It stuck in my mind, but I guess it could have been anyone."
I got up and slung the strap of my bag over my shoulder. "I better let you get back to work. Thanks for your time."
"I am not sure how much comfort I've provided. If the family have any other questions, I'd encourage them to get in touch, for peace of mind, if nothing else."
He stood, and we shook hands across the desk. This time his grip was ice cold, and his palm was damp. "Again, my condolences."
I liked him.
"I appreciate your saying so," I replied. I held up the booklet. "Thanks for this."
"My pleasure."
He smiled and resumed his seat, probably already thinking about the call he'd be returning as soon as I was out of earshot. It wasn't until I reached the door that I hesitated.
"One more question, if you wouldn't mind. I know this is out of line, and if you can't or don't want to answer, please say so."
He watched me and then made a little gesture indicating his willingness. "You said you checked on his medications. Was he taking glucotase or the placebo?" There was a silence during which he regarded me without expression. I didn't think he'd answer, and I could see him weigh the issue in his mind. Finally, he said, "I don't see any harm in telling you. The placebo." In the corridor, I paused for a short debate. Instead of heading for the exit, I returned to the clinic office. No sign of Greta. I reached over and picked up the appointment book, leafing back through the weeks as though I had every right. August, nothing. Tuesday, July 12th. Pete's name was penned into a 1 p.m. slot. Walking back to the parking lot, I gave careful consideration to the exchange. Dace had signed himself out of St. Terry's in June, after which he'd fled to Los Angeles. Dr. Reed had called me in hopes of finding him. Now he dismissed the incident. Plausible deniability is the term, I believe. Covering his ass was my take on it. What he couldn't disguise was the shift from a warm to an icy hand. Slick as he was, he couldn't control the physiology of fear. I gave Ruthie's front bell a twist and waited. She came to the door in a sweatshirt and jeans with a scarf knotted around her head. She had a dust rag in hand.
"Whew! Come in. I could use a break."
She stepped back and I moved into the foyer, saying, "I see you're getting life in order." She closed the door behind me and I followed her down the hall.
"I don't know about that. I have two closets emptied, which I consider a triumph. I don't suppose you have any use for 46 neckties. I gave him every one of those and he wore the same two all the time."
"No neckties. Sorry about that."
"Too bad. Some are nice. You got my message."
"I was off to an appointment, or I'd have picked up right then."
"I hope I didn't sound too cryptic."
I was properly intrigued. We'd reached the kitchen by then, which was much as it had been when I'd seen it last. Stacks of boxes, brown paper bags, and plastic bags filled to capacity. The counter littered with odds and ends. She picked up the sack of birdseed I'd dropped off the day before. She held it in her right hand as though to illustrate a point.
"So here's how this went. I decided I'd fill the bird feeder. That was always Pete's job, but I thought, what the heck? Poor little things must be starving to death. I had a chickadee bang into the window glass yesterday, and it about knocked itself out. Anyway, I get into the bag of birdseed and come up with this."
She pulled her left hand from behind her back
and held up a thick stack of bills folded in half and secured with a silver clip. The outermost denomination was a one. "He keeps small bills on the outside," she said when she saw my look. "How much?" "I didn't count. I figured if he robbed a bank, the cops would want to dust for prints."
"You don't really think he robbed a bank?"
"I don't know what to think."
"Didn't he say he was setting money aside for a cruise?"
"He said whatever sounded good. He never had this much money in his life."
I stared at her and then stared at the wad of bills. Sheepishly, she said,
"Okay. I did peek just a little bit. The bills on the inside are hundreds. Lots of them."
She handed me the money clip. I sat down at the table and riffled the corners of the bills. "I'd say $2,000 or $3,000.
"That's my guess."
She took out saucers and coffee cups and filled both from a thermos. She put a small pitcher of milk on the table and set the sugar bowl close by. Then she sat down.
"You know what bugs me? The bill collectors were hounding him, and I mean hounding him. A lot of it was nickel and dime stuff. I'm not saying the bills weren't overdue, but some were in the $200 to $300 range. There wasn't anything major, except maybe his back rent. It burns my ass to think how many debts he could have paid off with money like that."
"You know how he was. I'm sure in his mind paying bills wasn't any fun. That's why he avoided it. I'm sure he felt better saving for a trip, which was at least something positive."
"Oh, right. And thanks a bunch, pal. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that plan."
"If it's any comfort, he probably hadn't booked anything."
"Be thankful for small favors."
I put the clip of money on the table between us. "What are you thinking the source for this is?"
"You go first."
"No, you first. You were married to him."
"I think he was extorting money from someone.
Mid-July, he told me business was looking up. He had some kind of job he thought might net him a paycheck. I think a handsome chunk of change is the phrase he used. Well, he did pick up a job running surveillance in Reno. That's the work he asked Dietz to cover for him." Ruthie thought about that while the two of us stared at the wad of money.
"Do you really believe that's where it came from?"
"No." Ruthie actually laughed.
"I appreciate your honesty. I thought chances were good that it was hush money of some kind. Who was the victim? Do you have any idea?"
"Pete had only one job in the last 6 months, as far as we could tell. There are two or three people associated with that client, and of those, only one has money. A doctor out at UCST with something to hide. I was in his office less than an hour ago, and there's something off. Somehow, Pete picked up a whiff of it and cashed in. I can't prove it, of course, but I'd lay odds."
"Honestly, I'm not saying I approve. All I'm saying is if my husband was a crook, I wish he'd been better at money management," she said.
"With Pete, there's always something to forgive," I said.
"So, what do you advise? You think I should go to the police?"
"And say what? At this point, you really don't know anything for sure. That's part of what I'm trying to work out myself. I do think you have a point about preserving fingerprints. As long as you don't intend to spend the money, I'd leave it alone. Hide it somewhere good."
"Oh, you bet."
She propped her chin on her fist.
"I wasn't sure you knew about his tendency to play fast and loose. I wouldn't have said anything myself, but you understand where he was coming from."
"I knew him in the good old days, and he wasn't exactly a model citizen back then. Sweet guy," I added in haste.
"I can't tell you how much I miss him." Her smile was pained. "I guess one of these days I'll get used to it."
Chapter 32. When I arrived home, there was a parking spot right in front, which I took as a good sign. As I rounded the corner, moving into the backyard, I saw Henry in the act of closing his garage doors. He turned and picked up his four heavy plastic grocery bags, two in each hand. "I thought you'd already done your grocery shopping." "These are for Ed. I'm trying five different brands of wet food to see which he prefers. He turns his nose up at beef. He says cats don't eat cows."
"Opinionated little guy, isn't he?" When I came home Tuesday, he popped in for a visit just to have a look around. I was surprised he was out.
"Ed was out on Tuesday? I don't think so. He was in when I left, and he was in when I came home."
"That's because I put him in."
"How'd he manage to get out?"
"Beats me. Cats are mysterious. He might have transmogrified himself and slipped through the cracks like smoke," I said.
"You think he's capable of doing that?"
"How do I know? This is only the second or third cat I've met in my life."
"I'll have to keep an eye on him," he said.
"How was your meeting with Dr. Reed? I hope he put your mind at ease."
"I wouldn't go that far. There's still a big chunk of the story missing, and he's not the one who's going to fill me in. At any rate, talking to him was a good suggestion. I guess I should thank you for browbeating me into it."
"I'll take full credit."
As soon as I let myself into the studio, I went straight to the phone and called Ruthie. When she answered, I said, "Hey, Ruthie, Kinsey Milhone again. Forget the last name. You're the only Kinsey I know."
"Sorry about that. Force of habit.
Quick question I should have asked you while I was there. The guy who bought Pete's Fairlane pulled the junk out of the map pockets and the glove compartment. Do you still have that plastic bag?"
"I'm looking at it. I was just about to go through it. I need the proof of insurance card so I can call Allstate and cancel the coverage."
"Could you check and see if there's a parking ticket in there? Not a citation, from a pay lot. It'd be an ivory color with pale green stickers on the back."
"Hang on. I'm putting the receiver down, so don't go away."
"I won't."
"I'm turning the bag upside down, shaking everything out on the counter," she called.
"Ick! There's a dead bug. What the hell is that thing?"
"Take your time," I said.
She came back on the line.
"Good news. I found a savings passbook I didn't know we had."
"Okay, here. I'm looking at a ticket from UCST with stickers on the back."
"Is there a date and time stamp?"
"Says July 12th. Machine stamped at 12:45 p.m. when it was issued, but that's it. No time stamp going out or the machine would have eaten it."
"Hold on to that, okay? I'll pop over there first chance I get and pick it up."
"No problem."
I trotted up the spiral stairs to the loft where I unzipped my all-purpose dress and stepped out of it. Then I stripped off my pantyhose with a sigh of relief. I pulled on my usual workaday rags and went downstairs again. There was a knock at the door, and when I opened it, there stood Anna. She wore jeans and a blue knit top that made her blue eyes electric.
"I need to talk to you."
"Sure."
I stepped back, inviting her in.
"Sit anywhere you like."
She chose a kitchen stool. I moved around the counter to the other side so we were facing each other. I was aware that I was putting a barrier between us, but it felt appropriate. Given her demeanor, I wasn't sure how cozy this chat was going to be. I'd been irritated with her. Now it was payback time. She said,
"I called Ethan to give him Henry's number so he'd know where I was. He has questions."
"And what might those be?"
"Not for you."
"Ethan thinks I should talk to Daddy's doctor directly. Henry says you have his phone number."
"Dr. Reed wasn't his physician. He's in charge of the research program your father was enrolled in at one point.
I still want to talk to him if it's all the same to you.
May I say one thing first?
Say anything you like.
Your father was scared to death of Dr. Reed. He thought the test drug was killing him, and that's why he dropped out of the trial. I believe he was right. His friends are convinced of it, too, but of course Dr. Reed won't own up to that. According to him, your father was incapable of adhering to the guidelines, and the clinic gave him the boot. Why would he say that if it wasn't true?
He has an agenda of his own. He came up with a proposal about a drug he thought would be effective in treating addicts. Now it looks like he's being paid big bucks for a theory that isn't panning out.
Why should I take your word for it? You say Daddy changed his will because he was pissed off at us. Like it's our fault and we should just suck it up and let you have everything. I can see how that serves your purposes, but we're getting screwed.
I don't have a purpose except to see that his wishes are carried out.
But you never met him. Isn't that what you said?
That's correct. So you don't know what was going on in his mind?
That's true.
How do you know he wasn't suffering from dementia? Ethan thinks he could have been delusional or confused.
And Ethan's opinion is based on what?
The crazy way he behaved. He was mixed up or unbalanced or something.
Oh, I'm getting this. You'd like to think your father was mentally incompetent because that would invalidate the will.
You're hoping Dr. Reed will back you up.
That makes as much sense as your claim.
If that medication made him sick, why couldn't it have affected his mental state?
Always possible, I said.
So how do you know Dr. Reed wasn't trying to help? How do you know my father wouldn't be alive today if he'd done as he was told?
I don't know that, nor do you.
You want to talk to Dr. Reed? I can't stop you. But I can tell you right now, it's a bad idea.
I crossed to the desk, checked my notes, and jotted down Dr. Reed's number on a slip of paper. I tore the leaf off the scratch pad and presented it to her. His schedule's clear for the afternoon, so if you run like a bunny, you can talk to him today. Let me know what he says. I'll be interested in his response, I said.
Can I help you with anything else?
Get stuffed.
You too.
I opened the door for her. This time, she'd barely made it through before I banged it shut behind her. I closed my eyes, fighting for self-control. I was so irritated I could barely contain myself. I sat down. I took a deep breath. In a pinch, do something worthwhile. I clean the entire house. I let my gaze roam, and the first thing I saw was Pete's remaining cardboard box with a big X on the lid, partially covered by the folders I'd decided to keep. Where was I supposed to put the damn thing? I couldn't leave it where it was. My studio, while charming, is a bit short on storage space. In designing it, Henry had provided any number of nooks and crannies, built-in shelves and drawers, the oddly shaped cabinet here and there where a quirk of construction created a bonus cubby. I keep my possessions to a minimum, and even so, I'm occasionally forced to beg a few feet of shelf space in Henry's garage. I wasn't going to do that for Pete's junk. I did a 180-degree survey and finally took my foot and shoved the box to the back of the knee space under my desk. I glanced down and saw the name Eloise Cantrell written on the scratch pad above Drew's phone number. Under her name was a secondary note that said, CCU. I could feel my curiosity stirring along with a flicker of interest. The meeting with Dr. Reed had done little to erase the suspicions Dandy and Pearl had raised. Dr. Reed had met with Pete Walensky. Eloise Cantrell was the charge nurse in the cardiac care unit at St. Terry's when Dace had been admitted delirious. Soon afterward, he fled from the hospital and took a bus to Los Angeles. If he'd been frightened of Dr. Reed, she might have known why. Surely all of these matters were related. I picked up a pen and circled her name. I hadn't put a date on the note because I'd assumed the call was an error, never dreaming the contact might later seem significant. I opened the bottom drawer and pulled out the telephone directory. I flipped to the S's in the business listings and ran a finger down the page until I found Santa Teresa Hospital. There was a general number listed, a number for the emergency room, one for poison control, and then a few department numbers that could be dialed directly, including administration, billing, patient accounting, human resources, development, and public affairs. I reached for the handset and punched in the general number. When the operator picked up, I asked to be connected to cardiac care. I did this without conscious thought, thinking a plan might work to my detriment. Sometimes it doesn't pay to be too well prepared. The ward clerk answered, saying, "Cardiac care, this is Pamela." "Oh, hi, Pam. Is Eloise working today?" "She's in a staff meeting. Can I take a message?" "Do you know what time her shift ends?" "She told me, but I can't remember now what she said." "She's on 7 to 3. "Great. Thanks so much." I could tell Pam was ready to take a message, perhaps already making a note of the time on one of those while-you-were-out slips, but I hung up before she had a chance to quiz me. Now all I had to do was figure out what Eloise looked like. By 2:30, erring on the side of caution, I parked in the lot across the street from St. Terry's and made my way through the entrance and into the lobby. I asked for directions to CCU, and a volunteer walked me to the requisite corridor where, with pointing and gestures, she explained how to proceed. I wondered if I'd ever be nice enough to volunteer for anything. I was hoping not. When I reached the floor, I spotted a nurse's aide emerging from a supply room, her arms loaded with clean linens. I flagged her down and asked if Eloise Cantrell was available. "She's at the nurse's station." "Is she the little blonde?" With exaggerated patience, the nurse's aide said, "No. Eloise is 6 feet tall, and she's African-American." After that, it was no trick at all to pick Eloise from among the many white nurses at work. I took a seat in the waiting room within eyeshot of the nurse's station and leafed through an issue of a ladies' magazine that was only 4 years out of date. I was impressed by all the uses there were for instant vanilla pudding. This homemaking business, while beyond my modest aspirations, never failed to amaze. By the time Eloise left work, I was in the same corridor, lagging slightly behind to allow her to exit ahead of me. I followed her out of the building and tagged along in her wake. There were a number of pedestrians in the area, so she wasn't alerted to my presence. I waited until she turned the corner from Chapel onto Delgado before I closed the gap between us. "Eloise, is that you?" She turned, clearly expecting to see a familiar face. Her lips parted as though she meant to speak. "Kinsey Milhone," I said, pausing in case she wanted to rejoice. She was dark-skinned, her hair arranged in close lines of head-hugging braids, each of which ended in a sage-green bead that exactly matched her eyes. The hazel irises against the deep chocolate of her complexion was striking. I wouldn't describe her expression as hostile, but it wasn't welcoming. "You called me a few months ago looking for information about R.T. Dace." I waited to see if the name would ring a bell. "I thought you were saying Artie. Remember that? But you were talking about Randall Terrence Dace, R.T., I said, framing the initials in air quotes. Still no flash of recognition, so I tried again. "You asked for Mr. Milhone, thinking I was a guy." I could tell she remembered because she shut her mouth. "I was curious where you picked up my name and number." I could see her weighing the pros and cons of a reply. She said, "You were listed in the hospital chart as next of kin." Are you aware he died 10 days ago? I asked. Her tone was neutral.
I'm not surprised. He was in bad shape when I saw him last.
I was hoping you might answer a question or two.
Such as?
Did you know he'd enrolled in a drug trial?
She thought about her answer briefly and then said,
Yes.
Are you acquainted with the physician in charge?
Dr. Reed?
Yes.
Did he come into the CCU while Terence Dace was a patient?
Once as a visitor, yes.
What makes you ask?
Someone told me Dace signed himself out of CCU without the doctor's okay.
Her stare was unyielding.
Was there any discussion about why? I asked.
She dropped her gaze, which made her impossible to read.
I plowed on. His friends tell me he was scared to death of Dr. Reed.
I wondered what the problem was.
You have any idea?
She turned and began walking away from me.
I followed 6 feet behind, my voice embarrassingly plaintive even to my own ears.
I heard Dr. Reed terminated him for noncompliance, but he was sober when he died. No alcohol or drugs in his system, so what was going on?
She glanced back at me.
I work for the hospital. I'm not affiliated with the university.
You want information about Dr. Reed's work? Talk to him.
In the meantime, if you're hoping I'll sink to the level of rumor and gossip, you're out of luck.
She turned on her heel.
I stopped in my tracks and watched her walk away from me.
What had she said? If I was hoping she'd sink to the level of rumor and gossip?
What rumors? I called after her.
No answer.
I wasn't giving up on this. Henry had said that if I met with Reed and didn't feel he'd leveled with me, I should talk to someone else. Obviously, in approaching Eloise Cantrell, I was searching too far afield. Anything she knew would be hearsay. I needed someone more directly involved with him. The obvious answer was Mary Lee Bryce. She'd know what was going on behind the scenes. The problem was, I had no way to get to her without going through Willard. I could call her directly, but how would I explain who I was or why I was so interested in the work she did? I only knew about her because Willard had hired Pete. The notion of approaching him created a mild thrill of uneasiness. It wasn't my job to keep his dealings with Pete a secret from his wife. I wasn't responsible for protecting either of them. Willard wasn't my client, and Pete was dead. There was a certain subterranean moral code in play, but surely I could think of a way around that old thing. When I got home, I sat down at my desk and pulled out the 2 folders. After a brief search, I found Willard's address scratched on a piece of paper. Cherry Lane in Colgate. I locked the studio, hopped in the Mustang, and headed for the 101. Next thing I knew, I was knocking on Willard's door. I carried a clipboard, looking, I hoped, like my business was legitimate. In my heart of hearts, I did pray Mary Lee wouldn't answer the door. I wanted to talk to her, but I had other matters to cover first. I knew nothing about Willard. I'd seen photos of Mary Lee, but none of him. The man who responded to my knock struck me as strange the minute I laid eyes on him. His complexion was ruddy, and his skin looked dry. His ginger-colored hair was clipped close to his skull, and the tips of his ears were pink. I'd once seen a litter of newborn mice who had exhibited the same naked characteristics. His eyes were pale blue, and his lashes light. White dress shirt with the sleeves rolled up, baggy trousers. He rested his weight on forearm crutches, and one leg was gone.
Yes?
Mr. Bryce? He didn't own up to it, but he didn't deny it, so I moved right along. I held up my clipboard.
I'm a former colleague of Pete Walensky's. Again, no verbal response, but his complexion shifted, white patches appearing on a ground of pink. His mouth must have been dry because he licked his lips. I hope the man wasn't a serious poker player, because I could see now he might be a textbook study in physiological tells. You knew Pete was killed.
I read about it in the papers. Too bad.
Terrible, I said. That out of the way, I went on. His wife asked me to go through his business files for tax purposes, and I came across his report. I wonder if you could answer some questions. He shook his head.
I can't help. I don't have anything to say.
But you were a client of his.
No. Not really. I mean, I knew him, and we talked a couple of times, but that was it. More like friends.
Baffling, wasn't it? I looked down at the paper on my clipboard and allowed that little crease to form between my eyes. According to his records, he collected approximately, I can't read his writing here, it looks like $2,000, which you paid him to follow your wife. He glanced over his shoulder and then eased out the door. I leaned sideways and peered over his shoulder.
Oh, wow. Is she home?
No, she's out. I don't want to talk about this. My wife doesn't know anything, and I'd just as soon she not find out.
Is she at work?
She quit her job, if it's any business of yours. She's off at the supermarket. Look, I'll tell you what I can, but you have to be gone by the time she gets back.
Then we better be quick about it.
In Reno, she met twice with a man named Owen Penske. I gather he's an old high school friend. Do you have any idea what they talked about?
Lines appeared on Willard's forehead, and his upper lip lifted toward one side of his nose.
You said this was for tax purposes. I don't understand the relevance.
Don't ask me. I can't begin to guess why the IRS is looking into it.
The IRS?
This Penske fellow might be the focus of their investigation. I really have no idea. Pete was obviously concerned enough to make a note of it.
Well, yes. That was partly my doing. When she got back from Reno, she started shutting herself in the bedroom, making long-distance calls. When I told him about it, he thought there might be a problem.
Good guess on his part, I remarked.
I looked at him without comment, creating a small stretch of silence. Willard shifted his weight.
So what happened was he overheard a phone conversation between Mary Lee and Owen Penske.
How'd he manage that?
What?
How could Pete overhear a phone conversation? I'm not following.
He adjusted his crutches and stepped back.
I don't think I should say anything more. Maybe someone else can help.
Wait, I said. Hold on. I'm probably out of line here, Mr. Bryce, but in my past association with Pete, there were occasions when he employed a phone bug. Any chance of that here? Because if you gave your consent, you may be facing a serious legal issue.
I didn't consent. I was against it. I didn't like the idea at all. But he said if there was something going on, we might as well know the truth.
So you're saying he recorded a private conversation?
He might have without me knowing it.
You didn't hear the tape yourself?
No way. I paid him, and that's the last I saw of him.
What happened to the tape?
He kept it, I guess. If there was one.
I got that already. If there was one, where is it?
He didn't say anything more about it.
He dropped the matter?
I said, my tone incredulous.
Yes.
He let it go, and that was the end of it?
You're talking about Pete Walensky, is that correct? Because I can promise you, Pete never let anything go if there was money to be made.
Well, there was this other idea he had. He thought she might have something at work. You know, like in her desk, letters or something. So he came up with this plan to go into the lab using her employee badge, which I was supposed to give him. This was unexpected. I studied him with interest.
Really? When was this?
August 24th. But she turned in her notice that day, so all of a sudden it wasn't any big deal. She quit, and that was the end of it. I don't think she's talked to Penske since.
I said, ah.
I was sick of the whole thing by then anyway. I figured Pete was feeding me a line of bull, and I got tired of playing along.
What was your last contact with him?
The next morning. I guess he slept in his car all night, because the minute Mary Lee went off to work, he was knocking at my door, all rude and aggressive about why hadn't I handed over her ID. I fired him right then.
And that night he was shot to death.
Willard lifted a hand in protest.
Oh, no. No, no, it wasn't that night, was it?
The 25th.
No connection there, none whatsoever.
I stared.
I want to talk to your wife.
You can't do that.
She and Owen Penske had a subject under discussion, and she's the only one who knows what it was.
Well, no, that's not quite true. Penske knew, of course. And Pete knew, didn't he?
How would I know what Pete knew? Now get away from here. I don't have to talk to you. I only did this to be nice. You have no reason to bother my wife. You want to know what they talked about? Call Penske and ask him.
Good idea. I may do that, but I should warn you. If I don't get answers from him, I'll be talking to her.
No! Absolutely not!
I don't need your permission, Mr. Bryce. So if there's anything you want to fess up to, I'd suggest you do it soon. I took out a business card, slid it into his shirt pocket, and gave it a pat. I drove home in a state of suspended animation. I was sorry to learn Mary Lee had quit her job because she'd no longer have access to sensitive information. By the same token, maybe now that she was free as a bird, she'd be happy to blow the whistle on Reed. If Pete had overheard a discussion about the trial or the patients Reed had lost, it would have put him in the perfect position to collect. At my desk again, I pulled Pete's cardboard box into view and removed the lid. His tape recorder was still wedged in at one end where I remembered last seeing it. I removed it from the box and set it on the desk in front of me. I flipped open the lid and checked the cassette he'd left in place. I could see the bulk of the tape had progressed from the left spindle to the right side of the cassette. I pressed rewind and watched the spindles go round and round until they came to a stop. I closed my eyes briefly, wondering if there were truly angels up in heaven. Only one way to find out. I pressed play. The first conversation I picked up was clearly unrelated to my interests. It dawned on me, too late, of course, that I should have made a note of where the tape was before I'd so blithely run it back. I played and stopped my way through 50 minutes of other people's business, some of which was downright embarrassing. Finally, I heard a woman's voice and a phrase or two that made my ears perk up. Again, I had to back and forth until I caught the beginning of the segment. The sound quality was decent, but the recorder had picked up only half the conversation. A woman, sounding harried, said,
"It's me. I don't have much time, so let's make this quick. What's happening on your end?"
Having never heard Mary Lee Bryce's voice, I had no idea if I was hearing it now. Her phone mate said something that the recorder didn't pick up. Then she said,
"Not yet. I know where they are. I just can't get to them. I'm trying to track the one guy down, but it's tough. Can't you use the information I already gave you?"
I heard nothing while the person she was talking to said a few words. I didn't even know if it was a woman or a man. Guess it could have been a dog. Arf, arf.
"Owen, I know that. How do you think I spotted it in the first place? The pattern's there. What I don't have is proof. Meantime, I'm walking on eggshells.
Ah, Owen Penske and Mary Lee Bryce. How lovely to have you here.
Carry on,
she said.
I hope not. You don't understand how ruthless he is. It's fine as long as I'm in the lab, but I can't get anywhere near the clinic.
A question from Owen. Her reply.
The lab's in Southwick. The clinic's in the health sciences building.
I stopped the tape and scribbled as much as I remembered. I pressed play again. This was like a two-character radio drama. Mary Lee to Owen, Owen to Mary Lee, except that his comments were a blank. She might have been talking to herself.
Because that's where the subjects are seen for follow-up.
Whatever Owen said in answer was met with derision.
Oh, right,
said she. Talk about a red flag. And a moment later, I figured you'd appreciate the finer points. There was an exchange about a journal published in Germany. I listened, squinting, but couldn't see the relevance, so I moved past that bit and concentrated on the next. Mary Lee said,
Too bad is right. What he's doing here is worse. With the grant he got, he can't afford to fail.
Silence.
No. He has no clue I'm on to him. Otherwise, he'd have found a way to get rid of me before now. I mentioned his ripping me off because it's indicative of his...
I stopped the tape again and wrote down what I'd heard. My Aunt Jen had refused to let me take secretarial courses in high school, and I was royally pissed off about it now. If I'd been able to take shorthand, I could have made quick work of this. I pressed play again. I missed a garbled sentence or two, but I could have sworn she'd mentioned glucotase.
I have his password, but that's it so far.
Owen responded, silently.
It was written on a piece of paper in his desk drawer. How's that for clever?
Again, a pause for her response.
Because I saw the printout before he shredded it.
I pressed stop and play until I heard her say,
Not Stupak's, Linton's. These guys are always circling the wagons. Any hint of trouble, they close ranks. Shit, gotta go. Bye.
I could see how the deal had gone down. Pete had persuaded Willard to plant a pen mic, and this is what it had netted him. If the call had been recorded with a phone bug, both sides of the conversation would have been audible. As for the content, he must have recognized the value of what he'd heard. Given the way his mind worked, how could he not? That's when he must have done his homework, picking up background on Linton Reed and information on glucotase. I assumed he set up an appointment with Reed afterwards so the two could have a cozy heart-to-heart talk. What I couldn't see was where I might go with this. Linton Reed was wily. He was a cool customer, and all he had to do was sit tight. Whatever he'd been up to at work, he was never going to be caught out. If Pete was onto him and had hit him up for money, how would the facts come to light? Pete was dead. The tape would never be admissible in a court of law. Now what? Chapter 33 Late Friday afternoon, my curiosity finally got the better of me. I drove to Colgate and parked outside the apartment complex where Willard and Mary Lee lived. I knocked, this time hoping to catch her at home instead of him. She opened the door and regarded me briefly without saying a word. She was small. Her face was a perfect oval, her features fine. Her red hair was straight, chin-length, and cut jaggedly. Her forehead was high. A fine haze of red freckles gave her complexion a ruddy hue. Pale brows, blue eyes, with no visible lashes. Very red lips. She was a slip of a thing, so delicately built, that it made her feet look too big for her slender frame.
You're the private detective who was here.
Yes. Her smile was pained.
You'll be happy to know Willard told me everything. Full confession.
I wasn't sure what to say. I had no guarantee he'd actually told her the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so I was reluctant to interject a comment.
Can I have a few minutes of your time?
Why not?
I'm leaving, so it's lucky you caught me when you did. We can talk while I pack.
I followed her into the apartment. Willard was clearly somewhere else, so I didn't bother asking about him. She proceeded to the bedroom, which was small and painted white. The bed was neatly made, and a big soft-sided suitcase was sitting open on the spread. This was a room where the couple didn't seem to spend much time. Tidy, but no books. No easy chair, no reading lamp, and no photographs. The closet doors were open, and I could see that the space had been divided democratically. A quarter for him, three quarters for her. I took a position at the foot of the bed while she resumed her packing. She removed a pair of slacks from a hanger and folded them neatly before she placed them in the right half of the open suitcase. She had a packet of tissue paper on the bed, and she'd stuffed a sheet into the toe of each shoe before she tucked the pair in along the sides. She'd already packed underwear and sweaters. I said, "Where will you go?"
"A motel for the next few days. After that, I don't know."
"Did Willard explain why I was here?"
"Because you're a friend of the detective he hired."
"Not a friend. He was someone I'd worked with in the past."
"He sure had Willard wrapped around his little finger. I still can't believe he hired a guy to follow me. What was going on in his head?"
"I guess he was feeling insecure."
"He's an idiot. I wish I'd realized it earlier."
"He told me you quit your job."
"That's a move I'll live to regret," she said. "Jobs are scarce. I've been putting out resumes for 2 months and getting no response. From now on, I'll mind my own business, assuming I ever work again."
She returned to the closet, picked two hangers off the rod, and returned to the bed. She removed a dress from each of the hangers and folded them using tissue paper to minimize wrinkling. "Pete taped a telephone conversation between you and Owen Penske."
"That's nice. Did he plant cameras in the apartment so he could watch my every move?"
"He probably would have if he thought he could get away with it." She moved to the chest of drawers behind me and checked the first and second drawers. The first was empty. From the second drawer, she removed a stack of neatly folded T-shirts that she placed in the left side of her suitcase.
"Why are you so interested?"
"I'm distantly related to Terence Dace." She fixed a look on me.
"I'm sorry. I forget sometimes that life is about more than just me."
"Do you believe Dr. Reed was responsible for what happened to Terence?"
"Are you asking if I believe it or if I can prove it?"
"Either one."
"I don't think Dr. Reed's responsible in the same way a drunk driver's responsible in a hit-and-run fatality. All he was doing was protecting his own interests. Terence Dace was collateral damage."
"You know he stole three medical charts. His own, Charles Farmer's, and Sebastian Glenn's," I said.
"I wasn't aware of it, but good for him. Sebastian Glenn was the first death. Linton thought it was a fluke."
"But it wasn't."
"One is a fluke. Three is a pattern."
"Did they have something in common, a condition or a disease that put them at risk?"
"It's possible they had health issues. Pre-diabetic or undiagnosed diabetes. Heart problems, I really have no idea. Most patients did fine on glucotase. I had no access to the medical clinic where they were seen. I worked in the same lab with Linton, but not on the clinical trials he ran."
"You told Owen Penske that Dr. Reed shredded something. I'm not sure what it was. I only heard your half of the conversation."
"Raw data. The printout was sitting on his desk.
I caught a glimpse of the graph he'd done, which was a duplicate of the one he'd used in an earlier trial. How stupid is that? You'd think if he was going to cheat, he'd be more imaginative. So he was what? Misrepresenting his results? It's called trimming. If any values were too far out of line, he made adjustments.
Did you report it to anyone above him in the chain of command?
I couldn't see the point. The director of the grants program is the one who hired him in the first place. He thinks Linton is a star, especially since he's bringing money in.
Actually, I talked to Dr. Reed yesterday.
And how did he strike you? Is he a buffoon?
No.
Did he sweat? Did his hands shake? Did he hesitate?
Once, at the end of the conversation.
Well, trust me, he was either doing it for effect or trying to figure out an angle before he opened his mouth.
When we shook hands at the end of the interview, his were like ice. Her brows went up.
What the hell did you say to him?
I was asking questions about Dace. I thought he was being candid. He didn't seem tense or guarded. I know he was bullshitting on one point, but it was minor and I didn't want to press. She laughed.
That's our boy, Mr. Slick. I'm surprised you picked up on it.
There has to be a way to shut him down. Don't look at me.
Who better? Not to sound too cynical, but what makes you think anyone would listen to me? I'm the one he jilted. That's according to the rumor he's been spreading around. The first day I showed up for work, word was already out. His claim was we had an affair as undergraduates. That much was true. The way he tells it, I was needy and neurotic. I was jealous of his success, so he broke off the relationship. Now, if I say anything at all derogatory, it looks like sour grapes. A woman scorned.
What's the real story?
I broke up with him. He cribbed a paper. He stole my work. That's the kind of guy he is. He diddled with the title, added 5 co-authors, 2 of whom I swear to God he made up out of whole cloth. Then he sent it off to a scientific journal. When it appeared months later, I confronted him. Big mistake. You know how many papers I have to my name? 6. He's probably had 50 published in this year alone. That should be another little clue to the higher-ups. With that many, how does he have time to do his work?
Why did you apply for the job?
I screwed up. Big time. I knew it was his lab, but I'd forgotten how crazy he is.
But he's a bright guy. Why is he doing this?
Why does he do anything? Because he's high ego and he's a narcissist. Dangerous combination. He's not a man who deals well with stress. Something happened in Arkansas a few years ago. I don't have all the details, but a patient died and the error was traced to him. He couldn't face it. He suffered a total nervous breakdown and had to be carted off to the funny farm.
It didn't affect his career.
Not his career, his residency. Check his CV and you'll see the gap. That's when he moved from surgical oncology to research.
And if it happens again?
I hope I'm not around. This turns sour on him, then what? You want my best guess? He'll have a computer crash and lose everything. That way, they'll never nail him. Imagine all the sympathy he'll get. An entire year's work down the drain when he was doing so well.
I thought even with a crash there were ways to restore the files.
He could spill a cup of coffee down his CPU, or the lab might catch fire. He could go in and change a few numbers. The data could be sitting right there, but he'd be the only one who'd have access because no one else would know the magic keystrokes.
If I told you I had the charts in my possession, would that help?
It might. Look, I'm not the only one aware of what's going on. There's a postdoc in the lab who's seen the same things I have. Little signs of Linton's cooking, little things that don't quite add up.
Would this postdoc agree to talk to me?
No. He's married and has kids. You think he'd risk his livelihood? I can promise you he won't. Even if he did agree, you wouldn't have any idea what he was talking about. Isn't there anything I can do? She smiled briefly. You can do what I'm doing. Pack a bag and flee.
After I left, I sat in the car, as usual, making copious notes. Altogether, I was looking at 2 full decks of index cards, but this was new. Something had gone wrong in Arkansas. Linton suffered a nervous breakdown, and because of it, he switched his career path from surgical oncology to scientific research, which looked like a nice, safe place to land. Then, Sebastian Glenn had died. Once things started going wrong, he was back in the same place he'd been, only now he was married and had more to lose. Saturday morning, I drove the Mustang to the car wash to be detailed in preparation for Drew's taking possession. Miguel, who was doing the work, said it'd take an hour and a half. That was fine with me. My schedule was clear and I had time to spare. I told him I'd be in the waiting room, which was replete with 2 metal folding chairs and a wall-mounted display of car accessories for sale. I took out my paperback and settled in to read. This was a Robert Parker novel, in which Spencer and Hawk busted up bad guys so often it cheered me no end. 10 minutes went by and Miguel appeared. He might have been 19, remarkably poised for a guy who was working so hard to grow a mustache with so little to show for it. Miguel's auto detailing business was called Detailing by Miguel. He wore a black T-shirt with the company name emblazoned on it in red. He stood with his arms crossed, his hands pressed into opposite armpits. "You want me to leave the gun under the seat or put it somewhere else?" I ran the sentence through my head, diagramming the parts of speech as I recited it to myself. I keep my H&K in my briefcase, which I knew full well I'd moved from the trunk of the car to the studio before I'd left home. I don't have a gun in the car.
Lady, I don't mean to be fresh, but you do now.
I do? I slid the book into my bag and followed him out the back door and across the lot, passing the 2 lanes where cars were lined up to be vacuumed in preparation for a wash. He ran his one-man enterprise under a temporary awning that shielded him from the sun while he rubbed paste wax onto auto exteriors. With mine, he was still in the process of prepping the interior. The driver's side door stood open and his shop vac was close by. He pointed and stepped back, saying, "I didn't touch it." I leaned into the back seat and angled myself so I could see what he was talking about. On the floor under the driver's side seat, there was a .45-caliber semi-automatic handgun nestled up against the rail. I stared at it for a moment and then backed up a step so I could pull myself upright. I left the car door open. I glanced at Miguel and said, "Hang on." I hadn't put the gun under the seat, that much I knew. The only .45-caliber semi-automatic I'd heard mentioned of late was one of 2 guns missing in Pete Walensky's shooting death 2 months before. Cheney had mentioned it Monday night when he showed up at Rosie's. I had no way to calculate how many thousands of semi-automatics were floating around in the world. The number must have been astronomical, so what were the chances of that particular gun having been used in the robbery that ended Pete's life? I hadn't parked the Mustang anywhere near the bird refuge in months. The closest I'd come was the night I'd trundled along at 2 miles an hour, negotiating the access road along the property line at the back of the zoo. That was the unfortunate occasion when, having suffered a psychotic break, I'd agreed to run interference for Felix and Pearl in their mission to retrieve Dace's stolen backpack from the Boggarts' campsite. Those 2 locations, the strip of parking spaces near the lagoon
and the hobo camp up the hill were perhaps a quarter of a mile apart. Handguns, as a rule, don't hump from place to place of their own accord. Handgun migration is almost entirely the result of human intervention. But no one had been in the back seat of my Mustang except for Felix that same night. Miguel said, "You okay?" "I'm fine. Just give me a minute." I remembered stumbling onto the scene, having waded through the shrubs to warn them that the big boggart's arrival was imminent. While Pearl was stomping the makeshift incinerator, Felix had overturned a metal footlocker, and the contents were strewn across the ground at his feet. At the moment I caught sight of him, he picked up an item and shoved it into the waistband of his jeans at the small of his back. From that distance, and as quickly as he moved, I hadn't identified the object, but later, when he blasted the boggart with a can of pepper spray, I assumed that's what it was. He'd even admitted stealing the can of pepper spray from them. Had the boggarts stumbled across the 45 at the scene of the crime? The bird refuge was part of their turf, so the idea wasn't outside the realm of possibility. Cheney had speculated that the whereabouts of both missing firearms was the function of how far the guy could throw. If he'd tossed one gun in the lagoon and hurled the second one into the dark, it was possible one of the boggarts had spotted it by day. If that were the case, and if Felix had managed to steal it from them, then the savage beating he'd taken made a sudden twisted sense. That was if piled upon if, but that's sometimes how these things work. I closed the car door and locked it. I pulled a 10 out of my wallet and pressed it into Miguel's hand. "Keep an eye on the car. I'll be right back." I double-timed it into the building and found a payphone. I hauled out a handful of change, put a call through to the police department, and asked for Lieutenant Phillips. When I had Cheney on the line, I ran through a highly condensed version of what had happened the Tuesday before last, and why I thought the presence of a 45 under my car seat was relevant. I could tell the story made no sense, especially given my attempt to downplay both the raid and my part in it. To his credit, he didn't argue the point. He said he'd be there in 20 minutes, and he arrived in 15. I sat in his cubicle at the police department, the two of us eyeing one another warily, while I went through my story for the second time. I'd left the Mustang where it was so Miguel could finish his work. Cheney identified the gun as a 45 caliber Ruger. Before he removed it from under the seat, he'd photographed it in place, donned latex gloves, and then eased a pencil through the trigger guard to keep the handling of it to a minimum. Once the Ruger was bagged and tagged, he'd asked me to accompany him to the station. I agreed, so I'd appear to be morally upright. He said he'd drop me at the car wash later when we had a better sense of what was what. The Ruger might not be the missing weapon. It might not be relevant to any ongoing investigation, in which case it could end up in the property room, forgotten on a shelf. But I didn't see how it could be amiss. The stray casing found at the shooting scene was a 45 caliber ACP, which would have been a nice fit for the Ruger. On our way to his desk, he dropped the weapon off in the lab, where a ballistics expert would test fire it to see if the slug was a match for the one found at the scene. The Ruger's serial numbers had been